from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today in New York, John Kerry came out with his most sweeping attack yet on President Bush and his handling of Iraq.
Today, President Bush tells us that he would do everything all over again the same way. How can he possibly be serious? Is he really saying to America that if we know there was no imminent threat, no weapons of mass destruction, no ties to Al-Qaeda, the United States should have invaded Iraq? My answer, resoundingly, no.
And that was just the beginning. The Democratic challenger for the White House went hammer and tongs after the sitting president's record on Iraq, on his judgment as president, on the likely path of a Bush foreign policy in a second Bush term. Republicans heard the attack and fired back, calling Kerry a pessimist. But John Kerry seemed to find a voice today that the election season will hear more of. Later in this hour, we will hear Dan Rather's apology for missteps at CBS News. But first this hour, On Point, Kerry's attack on Bush policy in Iraq, his own plans for Iraq, and the Bush camp's reply. You can join the conversation. Is John Kerry making a persuasive case that President Bush has bungled Iraq? Who do you trust would do a better job with American foreign policy? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Matea Gold, staff reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She's been traveling with the Kerry campaign since February and attended the speech this morning at NYU. Matea, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Give us a sense of the candidate and the crowd this morning in New York.
Well, Kerry was received by an incredibly enthusiastic crowd. Obviously, here in New York is a friendly audience for him. And in many ways, he laid out his most cogent argument to date about Bush's handling of the war in Iraq and dissected the president's rationales and made a really strong case in terms of why he felt that the president had misled the country and why his rationales were not justified. Kerry managed to sidestep a lot of the issues that have boxed him in on this topic in the past and really tried to issue a strong challenge to the president's judgment.
Matea, ever since his remark standing along the Grand Canyon, that he would have voted the same knowing what he knows now in Iraq, John Kerry has seemed almost muted on this subject. Today he appeared to break out. How did he do that?
Well, it's interesting. His advisors have said while they plan on making the domestic agenda a major part of the remaining days of the race, their major focus, they now believe that Iraq is a huge weakness for the president and decided to confront him on it head on. In some ways, just kind of casting aside the problems that Kerry's had in the past and just plunging ahead. He said really in strong terms for the first time that the ousting of Saddam Hussein was not a reason enough alone to go to war in Iraq. It was kind of the clearest he had offered in terms of his thinking on that in the past. Of course, the Republicans immediately pounced on that and said it's a contradiction from what he said in the past.
And he went after President Bush on what he called a lack of candor. Let's listen to that from this morning in New York.
The first and most fundamental mistake was the president's failure to tell the truth to the American people. He failed to tell the truth. He failed to tell the truth about the rationale for going to war, and he failed to tell the truth about the burden this war would impose on our soldiers and our citizens. By one count, the president offered 23 different rationales for this war. If his purpose was to confuse and mislead the American people, he succeeded. His two main rationales, weapons of mass destruction and the Al-Qaeda September 11th connection, have both been proved false by the president's own weapons inspectors and by the 9/11 Commission. And just last week, Secretary of State Powell acknowledged those facts. Only Vice President Cheney still insists that the earth is flat.
John Kerry this morning in New York, and we will hear more from that speech. Matea Gold with the LA Times, do you expect now to hear this as a repeated theme? Is this the new Kerry stump speech as we head toward Election Day?
Well, what we've actually seen in the last few weeks is that Kerry has really finally, I think, hit on a theme for his candidacy. and that is that he is accusing Bush of having bad judgment, making the wrong decisions, and arguing that he would take the country in the right direction. This is kind of the best crystallization so far of Kerry's message about why people should vote for him. Of course, people wonder if it's coming a little too late in the race to help him, but his advisors say he's going to make that case about judgment when it comes to both Iraq and the domestic agenda. They don't want to cede ground on either one of those issues.
Mateo Gold, stand by. We're joined now from Washington by Jamie Rubin. He's a senior advisor to the Kerry Edwards campaign, former Assistant Secretary of State under Madeleine Albright. Jamie Rubin, thanks for joining us tonight.
Nice to be with you.
So how should we interpret John Kerry's all-guns-blazing attack on Bush-Iraq policy today? Where is this campaign headed with this message, Jamie?
Well, I think we're now in the fall campaign in full-throated debate, and John Kerry has laid very clearly the debate before the American people. He has said that there were no weapons of mass destruction, there was no link to Al-Qaeda, there are now, it's a terrorist haven in Iraq, we've alienated allies, we've let bin Laden escape from our grasp in Afghanistan, and the job isn't finished there, and you add all that up, and he said that the war in Iraq was a mistake, was a colossal misjudgment that has made us less secure, not more secure.
Jamie Rubin, why has John Kerry taken so long to speak this forcefully on this subject?
Well, he gave a full speech in the springtime on Iraq, and I think at that time many of us were hoping that President Bush would make the right decisions, would change course from the course that we'd been on. But during the course of the summer, it's become increasingly clear that President Bush is going to stay this failed course, and John Kerry believes that now that the fall debate is in full throes, that it's appropriate to lay down the clear differences. And I think the other new factor is that President Bush actually had the audacity to tell the American people just a couple of weeks ago that knowing everything that's happened, he wouldn't do a thing differently. Knowing that we didn't have enough troops, knowing that there was looting, knowing that the chaos just gets worse and worse, knowing that we went to war over weapons of mass destruction and there are no weapons of mass destruction, there's no link to Al-Qaeda, President Bush actually told the American people that he has no regrets, he'd do nothing differently. That is a fundamental judgment and probably the single most important fact about this election. The president has made these misjudgments. It's clear to everyone to see that the situation in Iraq is getting worse and worse, and this president has now told us he wouldn't do a thing differently.
And John Kerry went directly at that today, framing it in very strong terms. Jamie Rubin, Mateo Gold, stick with me. Let's listen to a little more of John Kerry in New York this morning.
His miscalculations were not the equivalent of accounting errors. They were colossal failures of judgment, and judgment is what we look for in a president. This is all the more stunning because we're not talking about 2020 hindsight. We're not talking about Monday morning quarterbacking. Before the war, before he chose to go to war, bipartisan congressional hearings, major outside studies, and even some in his own administration predicted virtually every problem that we face in Iraq today. This president was in denial. He hitched his wagon to the ideologues who surround him, filtering out those who disagreed, including leaders of his own party and the uniformed military. The result is a long litany of misjudgments with terrible and real consequences. The administration told us we would be greeted as liberators. They were wrong. They told us not to worry about the looting or the sorry state of Iraq's infrastructure. They were wrong. They told us we had enough troops to provide security and stability, defeat the insurgents, guard the borders, and secure the arms depots. They were tragically wrong.
We are going to hear in a moment from the Bush camp on Kerry's speech today, but they've already been speaking out this morning. What do we have? I guess calling John Kerry pessimistic and defeatist. We heard from Steve Schmidt in the Bush campaign. Jamie Rubin, do we have a John Kerry that just doesn't see the vision, doesn't see the opportunity, that is defeatist here?
Well, I think the American people are going to see through that kind of campaign rhetoric. This war has been going on for a long time now. And I think what John Kerry is saying today is that an effective president, a president with judgment, would level with the American people. You know, George Bush often talks about Winston Churchill. I guess he's got a statue of him in his office. Winston Churchill became famous in England during World War II for speaking the truth to the British people, the hard truths, and telling them that they needed to deal with the difficulties. And this president has been giving us happy talk after happy talk, week after week, telling us that we're on the road to democracy. When even Republican senators over the weekend finally had enough and said that we're in deep trouble in Iraq. And I think the American people are smart enough when this is all over to say, now, do I want a president who's got the judgment and the honesty to tell me when something is going wrong and to propose a concrete new course to fix it? Or do I want a president who's shown me bad judgment after bad judgment, says everything's fine and stick with me and have more bad judgment?
Mattea Gold, Jamie Rubin has a horse in this race, clearly. You don't. What's your sense of how this is likely to play? The Bush camp has beaten up on Kerry for months now, saying he's a flip-flopper, he's inconsistent. President Bush suggesting the same thing after Kerry's speech this morning.
Sure.
Does he come out of this less vulnerable? Is he regaining the initiative here? How do you see it?
Well, I mean, I think it's a little too soon to tell how the speech is going to affect the contours of the race, but I think it's clear that Iraq has both peril and promise for Kerry in many ways. I mean, and the issue has tied him up throughout the course of the campaign as he's attempted to clarify how he would handle things differently than the president. Recent poll in the New York Times showed kind of these two forces. While 80% of the country feels misled in some way about how the president has made his case for going to war, 60% don't have confidence in John Kerry's ability to handle foreign policy crises. So I think that's his real challenge, is to make that case and win those people over in the coming weeks.
Jamie Rubin, he laid out his own four-point plan today. Could you take us through those points quickly?
Yes, absolutely. First and foremost, he called on President Bush to do what's been promised for many, many months now, and that is to get support from our friends and allies, specifically by calling a summit and asking them to live up to the UN resolution, calling on them to send troops and assistance. For NATO allies, that might mean the mission of border control or training Iraqi forces. Secondly, we have to get those Iraqi forces trained. The Bush administration continues to mislead us about how that program is going. He proposed specific ideas to have training done within NATO countries so that we get that job done quickly so that our troops can come home. Thirdly, on reconstruction, he made very clear that we haven't done reconstruction. We authorized, appropriated $18 billion, and only a tiny fraction of that has been spent because the program has been mismanaged. Even Republican senators have called it incompetent. Instead, we need to pick some high-profile projects, things that can be done quickly, things that can show the Iraqi people that that they're going to have a brighter future. Fourth and finally, we have to have elections in Iraq, elections in January. To have those elections, the UN is going to need some protection for the election monitors. And the president has to get other countries to step up to the plate to provide those monitors, because if we don't have elections, we're not going to have the kind of government that the Iraqi people are going to defend and support against the terrorists and insurgents who are fighting every single day. Those are four very concrete plans, but the key point here is that the judgment of this current president is not trusted around the world. He told the world there were weapons of mass destruction. There weren't. He told the world this was going to be easy. It wasn't. He told the world we didn't need their help, and we didn't get it. So in order to get those four points accomplished, we are going to need a president who's judgment is respected, and that means we're going to need a new president.
Well, the sitting president will be at the UN tomorrow. We'll be following that. Mattea Gold, been following John Kerry's campaign for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Great to hear from you. Jamie Rubin, stick with us. We're going to hear from the Bush camp when we come back. We're talking tonight about John Kerry on the attack over Iraq. Is Kerry making a persuasive case that President Bush has bungled Iraq? Is he, as the GOP charges, succumbing to pessimism? Or is he telling it like it is? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about John Kerry on the attack over Iraq, out today with his strongest attack to date of President Bush's Iraq policy and laying down his own game plan for Iraq. Let's listen to John Kerry today justifying his own vote to authorize force, even though he didn't like the way he said was prosecuted.
2 years ago, Congress was right to give the president the authority to use force to hold Saddam Hussein accountable. This president, any president, would have needed that threat of force to act effectively. This president misused that authority. The power entrusted to the president purposefully gave him a strong hand to play in the international community. The idea was simple. We would get the weapons inspectors back in to verify whether or not Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And we would convince the world to speak with one voice to Saddam, disarm or be disarmed. A month before the war, President Bush told the nation, if we have to act, we will take every precaution that is possible. We will plan carefully. We will act with the full power of the United States military. We will act with allies at our side, and we will prevail. He said that military action was not unavoidable. Instead, the president rushed to war without letting the weapons inspectors finish their work. He went purposefully, by choice, without a broad and deep coalition of allies. He acted by choice, without making sure that our troops even had enough body armor. And he plunged ahead by choice without understanding or preparing for the consequences of post-war, none of which I would have done.
Presidential candidate John Kerry in New York today challenging President Bush's Iraq policy on what seemed like practically every front. We've been joined tonight by Jamie Rubin, senior advisor to the Kerry Edwards campaign, former assistant secretary of state under Madeleine Albright. We're joined now from Washington by Danielle Pletka, vice president of foreign and defense policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, former staff member for the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Danielle Pletka, thanks for being with us tonight. Did you hear John Kerry today, and what did you think?
I did hear John Kerry today. I watched his whole speech. I thought it was a very forcefully delivered speech. Well-delivered and well-written. I was a little bit disappointed to see that he's changed his mind on Iraq again. I was a little bit disappointed to hear him being quite so negative on the prospects for Iraq and on the prospects for the future of Iraq. And I was very, very surprised to see that the plan that he laid out was left to the end of his speech and really didn't consist of doing anything different from what the current administration is doing, but it did consist of doing it better. I guess at the end of the day, I thought that Senator Kerry's message that it would be better, we would be better off, we would be safer if Saddam Hussein were still in power is not a message that I agree with. It's not a message that he agrees with, because, if I may quote for a second, those who doubted whether Iraq or the world would be better off without Saddam Hussein, and those who believe we are not safer with his capture don't have the judgment to be president or the credibility to be elected president. Those aren't my words. Those are John Kerry's words.
So the bottom line you're taking issue with here, you describe the bottom line that way. What about his pounding critique of the prosecution of this war? George Bush has taken some blows from inside his own party in the last few days, Chuck Hagel, Richard Lugar, and others. I mean, you've backed the Bush policy generally, but you're not inside the Bush reelection campaign. How do you see that critique, whether from John Kerry or his own Republican senators, Danielle Pletka?
I think that it's very important in our society to have an open debate. There's no question that we face difficulties in Iraq, and just speaking for myself, certainly there were some unforeseen problems. I'm not a political strategist. Were I a political strategist, I perhaps would not base my strategy on the backs of casualties in Iraq and on the backs of terrorist actions in Iraq. I think that the problem here is not just that there has been criticism from John Kerry, which I think is absolutely fair game. I think the problem is that he has never been willing to tell the American people what it is that he would be doing differently. Today he said, okay, yes, he would have left Saddam Hussein in power. But he didn't say that last week, and I'm not sure he'll say that next week. I don't agree with that statement, just as a sort of a bottom line matter of policy. But in addition, the whole question of training, you know, intensive training is going on. More than 100,000 Iraqis have been trained. Now, John Kerry may not appreciate the way they've been trained.
Well I must say even many Republicans don't seem to appreciate it, and that number is a matter of some dispute right now.
Well, you know, I can only go by the numbers that I see, and I can go by the numbers that I receive from the Iraqi government. Now, if John Kerry wants to say that those are lies, that's certainly his prerogative. I can't accept the idea that everything that the administration puts out is a lie, that everything that the Iraqi government puts out is a lie. Iraqis have been training, and I've seen them myself, for well over a year. Is it a perfect operation? Absolutely not. And let's not pretend that we haven't had difficulties or that it isn't a genuine challenge. But the thing of it is, Jamie actually mentioned, and hi, Jamie, by the way. Jamie mentioned Winston Churchill. The message that I get again from John Kerry is that were he in the position Winston Churchill were in 1940, he would have said, you know what, this is really too hard, let's go away, let's turn around. Things aren't going well at all in the war. And maybe in 1942 he would have said it again. And we are going to face a lot of difficulty in Iraq. It's not easy, it's not a game, and we're going to make some real mistakes. There's just no question. We have to be frank and we have to admit that. But this is worth seeing through. This was the right thing to do. And at the end of the day, the American people will be better off, and the Iraqi people will be better off, and the Middle East will be better off. Mm. We have to stick with that conviction. I think it's really, really important not to go with the ebb and flow of the headlines every single day. Yes, I'd stay. No, I wouldn't stay, depending on whether that day had been good or not.
Daniel Plitka, we've got it. Jimmy Rubin, let me put it to you. Did John Kerry flip-flop today? Would he, as Daniel Plitka suggests, and perhaps his speech itself, would he have left Saddam Hussein in power?
No. What John Kerry has said consistently is invading Iraq could only be justified on the basis of the threat of weapons of mass destruction, invading Iraq with an American army. And what he's asking the voters to do is just to add it up. And to say, are we better off now? Yes, Saddam Hussein is out of power, but we've taken our focus off Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, which are the primary threat to the United States. No, there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no link to al-Qaeda. Iraq is now a terrorist haven. The situation is getting worse. That's just an honest assessment. That's not defeatism. That's realism. And the rest of the world has lost respect for the United States. It is that much harder to get them to support us in defeating al-Qaeda. When you add up all of these factors and you make a calculation, is the United States more secure having avoided dealing with countries like North Korea and Iran that pose a real threat of weapons of mass destruction to defeat Iraq, which had no weapons of mass destruction? When you look at the long-term consequences of the rest of the world not trusting America's judgment. We said we were going to war over weapons of mass destruction. There are no weapons of mass destruction. You put all this together, the American people have a right to expect their leader to do what's right for our national security. Our national security covers all of the issues I mentioned. And when you add all that up, the calculation seems pretty straightforward. Because of the way the Bush administration handled this, because of their incompetence and their bad judgment, America is worse off. But does that mean we should cut and run? Nobody is suggesting that. And anyone who isn't listening to John Kerry. What he's suggesting is that we need a leader who's got better judgment than George Bush showed. He showed failures of judgment time after time after time. If we want to keep on the same course with the same bad judgment, vote for George Bush. But if you know that this situation is getting worse and we need a president who can restore respect for the United States, get the judgment, have the kind of judgment that others will respect, not reject, then we need a new president so that we can succeed in Iraq and all of the successes that our troops have fought for will be vindicated. We're not going to do that by staying the course when the course isn't working.
Let's listen to Kerry's words today. Here he's talking about how weapons of mass destruction were not found. The Bush administration talked about the eventual capability being there and going after that. Here's John Kerry.
35 to 40 countries have greater capability to build a nuclear bomb than Iraq did in 2003. Is President Bush saying we should invade all of them? I would have personally concentrated our power and resources on defeating global terrorism and capturing Osama bin Laden. I would have tightened the noose and continued to pressure and isolate Saddam Hussein, who was getting weak, who was weak and getting weaker, so that he would pose no threat to the region or to America. The president's insistence that he would do the same thing all over again in Iraq is a clear warning for the future, and it makes the choice in this election clear. More of the same with President Bush, or a new, smarter direction with John Kerry that makes our troops and America safer? That's the choice.
Daniel Pletka, the assertion here, just between the lines in John Kerry's speech this morning, that President Bush is likely to roll across more borders if he's given a second term. More of the same with President Bush, he says. Do you accept that?
Well, I don't know what Senator Kerry means. If he means that President Bush is going to be very aggressive in protecting America's national security interests in the face of terrorist threats, in the face of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, I suppose that that's right. If he means that we are on track for more conflict and more war, I think that's very unlikely. I certainly don't want to see any president, no matter who he is, take any options off the table as we confront terrible regimes such as the Iranian regime or the North Korean regime. But to suggest that there is somehow another conflict imminent, I think is perhaps a little disingenuous. And to be fair, I will say that I actually did not hear that in the senator's speech. I don't think that was what he was saying. Maybe I misheard.
It's possible, but it had that tinge to it, more of the same from President Bush. Let's hear from our callers. Seth is calling from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Hi, Seth. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
It's all right, Seth.
Excellent. This morning I heard on the radio a preview of what people expected that John Kerry would say and mentioned his four-point plan. And I was like, all right, cool. Let's hear what Kerry is actually going to do to make the Iraq war go better.
So what do you think of it, Seth?
Well, I think it's a farce. I think his first point, that he wants to get the other nations of the world to send troops to Iraq,
right,
is pure fantasy. Can you imagine the French at this point in the game actually agreeing to send tanks and infantry to the streets of Baghdad, or the Germans, or the Russians, or pretty much anybody else that John Kerry is talking about that wasn't on our side? It's pure fantasy.
So you don't see more international support coming? What about the other three? What about the rest?
Okay, the other three, as far as training the Iraqis, I mean, from the very first week of the operation, we were setting up training for Iraqi police, for Iraqi security guards, for border patrol people, for installation security, and for the army. The army took Major General David Petraeus, who I think was the 101st Airborne Commander.
But that seems to have failed again and again. We've seen the performance in different skirmishes, and we've heard that the private outfits brought in to do that just haven't done it well at all.
Well, the point is that the army is putting great effort into training Iraqi forces, and in 1 year, you don't start from scratch and build a professional class army. Our army is an ongoing project that's taken us decades to get where we're at. The fact of the matter is, the army is the same, the brass is the same, most of the Pentagon staff is the same. If John Kerry were president, what exactly would be these same people in Iraq today do differently than these same people are doing in Iraq already?
Seth, let us pick those up. Jamie Rubin, first of all, John Kerry always talks about more international support. There are many skeptics who say, what further support is he talking about? We are not going to see NATO troops most likely on the ground in any strength in Iraq under any kind of American presidency. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, there's no country in the world who would announce that they would do more for a Kerry administration than a Bush administration. So I don't think we should assume that you could prove it.
But you know what public opinion is in these countries. It doesn't seem that it would be supportive of the idea of sending troops to back us up there.
There's no question this is going to be difficult because of the failures and miscalculations of this administration. But I think it's just as true that the rest of the world will breathe a huge sigh of relief if a new president comes into office, a president who knows how to listen and lead rather than reject and disdain the views of others. And I think we'll have a far better chance. And the kind of programs that John Kerry has proposed is to, for example, we have a terrible border problem in Iraq. People are coming in and out of the borders. Mm-hmm. The caller's probably right. There won't be French troops and tanks rushing into Baghdad. But I think it's reasonable with a new president to say to our allies, look, we can agree to disagree about how we got into this war, but I'm going to try to persuade you that we're all going to be worse off if we fail here. And I think a president whose judgment is not challenged, whose judgment is not rejected, a president who doesn't carry all the baggage of the run-up to this war will have a far better chance to convince other countries to do things like border control, which is not nearly as dangerous as Baghdad. On training, the same applies. You know, the caller pointed out correctly that Major General Petraeus is very well respected. The caller obviously didn't read the paper yesterday. Petraeus is not getting the civilian support that he needs. He's not getting the top civilian leaders, the political leaders of our country, to provide him the resources to get this job done. They haven't realized the urgency of this situation and haven't directed resources to be put at Petraeus's disposal. Similarly, other NATO countries could set up training centers in their own country. Right. To do this. What we need is a new reflection of the world's recognition that we're all in this together. They're not going to get that under George Bush. If you don't care about the fact that 90% of the forces, 90% of the burden, 90% of the cost is going to be borne by America, and if you think we should just continue how we've been going, then I think Bush is your man. But if you think we need a change in course and we need a fresh start so that the rest of the world will look at its own interests rather than be busy being angry at Bush for the failed diplomacy of 2003, then I think John Kerry can help bring us that success. We'll have a far better chance in a Kerry administration than we'll have under
Daniel Plitka, our time is very short. Let me just ask you this. Do you think George Bush is politically vulnerable on this front with what's going on in Iraq or not, essentially?
I'm sorry. You were addressing that to me.
Yes.
I think at the end of the day, the American people are going to look at what the president has done and say, we do not want a president who changes his mind with the weather, who changes his mind with the headlines, who tries to persuade us that he must be right because the people of France agree with him. I don't think that's what we want in our leaders. Yes, we would absolutely love to have more burden sharing in Iraq, but let's not hold out the false hope that the French Foreign Legion is on the way.
And with that, we're out of time. Daniel Plitka at the American Enterprise Institute, thank you for joining us tonight. And Jamie Rubin, also in Washington, senior advisor to the Kerry Edwards campaign, thanks for being on board.
Thank you.
After the break, apologies from Dan Rather. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, CBS News anchor Dan Rather is again in the news. A former National Guard officer deliberately misled CBS in its September 8th 60 Minutes segment on President Bush's National Guard service, the network said today. White House spokesman Scott McClellan responded that there are still, quote, serious questions, unquote, that CBS and Dan Rather need to answer. And less than an hour ago, Dan Rather himself explained on CBS Evening News how he was misled.
Now, news about CBS News and the questions surrounding documents we aired on this broadcast and on the Wednesday edition of 60 Minutes on September 8th. The documents purported to show that George W. Bush received preferential treatment during his years in the Texas Air National Guard. At the time, CBS News and this reporter fully believed the documents were genuine. Tonight, after further investigation, we can no longer vouch for their authenticity. The documents were provided to CBS News by a former commander in the Texas Air Guard, Bill Burkett. He did not come to us. We went to him and asked him for the documents. Burkett is well known in National Guard circles for a long battle over his medical benefits and for trying for several years now to discredit President Bush's military service record. Burkett initially told CBS News he got the documents from a fellow guardsman. But when we interviewed Burkett this past weekend, he changed his story and told us he got the documents from a different source, one we cannot verify. Why did Burkett tell CBS News something he now says is not true? We put the question to him. Why did you mislead us?
Well, I didn't totally mislead you. I did mislead you on the one individual. You know, your staff pressured me to a point to reveal that source.
Well, we were trying to get the chain of possession.
I understand.
And
that.
You said you had received them from someone.
I understand.
And
that.
We did press you to say, well, you received them from someone, and that
yes.
someone was whom. And it's true, we pressured you because it was a very important
yes.
point for us.
And I simply threw out a name that was basically, it was, I guess, to get a little pressure off for a moment.
Have you forged anything?
No, sir.
Have you faked anything?
No, sir.
But you did mislead us. You
yes,
used
I
the word lie. You,
yes,
you,
I did.
You lied to us. Why would I or anyone believe that you wouldn't mislead us about something else?
I could understand that question. I can. That's going to have to be your judgment and anybody else's.
Following the Bill Burkett interview, Rather went on to apologize personally for the CBS mistake.
The failure of CBS News to do just that, to properly, fully scrutinize the documents and their source, led to our airing the documents when we should not have done so. It was a mistake. CBS News deeply regrets it. Also, I want to say personally and directly, I'm sorry.
Joining me now from New York is Joe Hagan, television columnist for the New York Observer. He's been following the uproar over CBS's coverage of the president's guard service. Joe Hagan, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So many millions of people will have heard Dan Rather, and others will hear him in repeats on media all over the place. Where do you think this statement, the apologies today, the admissions of mistakes by CBS and Dan Rather, where do they leave this story?
Well, they now leave it somewhere inside the headquarters of CBS News, where now there's going to be incredible internal soul-searching to, as well as a lot of probably political aspects to figuring out who's to blame, how, you know, where's the blame going to go, and what's the result of it in terms of, is someone going to be fired? Is Dan Rather's career over? These kinds of things.
What are you hearing in New York from CBS, to the extent that anyone's hearing, about how secure Dan Rather's job is at this point?
Well, people are keeping pretty mum about it because these things are going to be happening on basically the highest level of CBS. I mean, you're talking about now yeah. talking about Les Moonves. We're talking about Viacom and, you know, these kinds of powers. I mean, the fact is Dan Rather is the elder statesman of the big three network anchors. And he's held on to his job as long as he has because he's very powerful inside that company, and he has been for a long time. And it's kind of well known that he's had more power than CBS News president Andrew Hayward for some time, I mean, on a lot of levels in terms of keeping his gig. And there's a lot of reason for them to have kept him on because he's the brand face of the network in a, you know, in the kind of waning days of an era in which anchors were representing the brand.
Joe, take us in shorthand, because I know it's a twisting saga, but how did it come to this point for CBS tonight? They went out to do a story on Bush's National Guard service. Others were doing stories on that service.
Right.
Somehow, they ended up in the ringer, as Dan Rather might say.
Right. Well, they were profoundly confident about this story, and for reasons that have yet to be clear to anyone. I mean, the first mistake they made is they trusted the word of individuals in coming to grips with if this document was these documents were real or not.
And we heard Burkett backpedaling like crazy there right now.
Right. They've they didn't really give enough credence. CBS didn't give enough credence to the forensics of this document. They thought they had it in the bag because A, the White House looked at it and said, "Oh, we're not denying this is real." They had the guy who allegedly had written it, his former boss, says, "Yeah, it sounds like things he said."
Yep.
And then importantly, and what Rather has said over and over again is that there was a wealth of evidence, he says, supporting the truth of what was in these documents But these documents were the smoking gun that he had to have to put it on the air. So you can see that he was probably just yearning and dying to get the story out because he thought it was true based on some other evidence that we can't know. Whatever that is, I have no idea.
Right. He's saying it doesn't all depend on these documents, however flawed they may have been.
Right. So that's what he's sort of maintaining, even today. But, you know, the story of this story is kind of an amazing – I mean, it'll go down in the annals of journalism as something everybody should pay attention to because it's really fascinating to watch in front of everyone's eyes this story fall apart day after day, and also the political forces that were driving it.
We're going to talk about all that. Joe Hagan, thanks for catching us up on exactly where it stands at this moment. Thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Of course.
Joe Hagan, television columnist with the New York Observer. We are joined now from New York by Frank Rich, columnist and associate editor for the New York Times. Frank Rich, great to have you tonight. What do you make of Dan Rather's very public apology?
Well, I think it's obviously the step they had to take based on what we've now been told. The only route CBS has is to try to be as candid and transparent as possible, and so they've begun that process.
Do you think he can survive?
I honestly don't know. To me, this is, you know, you don't know. Look, I work for the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
which went through its own debacle with Jason Blair, and I couldn't have told you when the Jason Blair thing broke that it would lead, as it did, to the resignation of the editor of the paper, Howell Rein. So it's sort of, and I was inside that organization.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not inside CBS News. This will play out, but to me, the really momentous part of this is way beyond whatever does or doesn't happen to CBS or what happens to Dan Rather's career.
Yeah.
We live in a time where news is changing very rapidly. We're in the conventions that just ended. The broadcast networks elected not to cover most of them.
Right.
And Fox News, which I regard, as many do, as a partisan network, beat everybody in the ratings during the Republican mm-hmm. convention. There's news that's slanted. There's news that's gimmicky, and the last thing we need in the mix is for reputable news organizations to trade in fiction. Now, it's happened many times in the past. It's happened to many of the major institutions, not just CBS News and the New York Times, but this is a particularly perilous moment for it to happen, and on this scale and with a story involving the President of the United States during a political campaign, divisive as it is.
Mm-hmm. Frank Rich, let me ask you on just that point. The New York Times editorial page said, opined with some pleasure last week that they believe that this uproar over Rather in this story marked a kind of divide, and that the establishment media, which they would regard as liberal media, has now, passed its glory days and is on the decline. What do you think?
Well, I can't speak for the editorial page of the Times, but
that was the Wall Street Journal, I should say.
I'm going to say, yeah, that doesn't sound like
that was
would
the
say,
Journal. Pardon me if I misspoke.
But I thought maybe I was having a little momentary amnesia.
No.
This kind of gloating, particularly from a newspaper that produced five volumes of journalism about Whitewater and which gave credence in its own columns to reports of Clinton's being involved in drug deals and all sorts of things that never materialized is ridiculous, but it shows where we are. It shows how partisan it's all become. And the truth is that the Wall Street Journal is a newspaper, is a very straight newspaper, or tries to be, just as the Times and the Washington Post do. Mm. And its editorial page has an agenda, and I don't think it really speaks for the journalism profession. But the fact is that the world is changing. It's particularly changing on television. I think that, as Joe Hagan said, we're seeing the twilight, anyway, of the evening news and of the anchors as we knew them. They still have large audiences, but they're declining and they're aging very rapidly. You can just see that from the commercials you see on those shows.
Right.
And what is going to fill that vacuum? Is it going to be somehow strengthened print journalism in this electronic world, a print journalism that maybe finds a new way to get its story across on the the net, or is it going to be partisan networks, whether a conservative one like Fox or someone going to try to turn another into a liberal one or create a liberal one? None of this, I think, has anything to do with the actual standards of journalism, which are supposed to be nonpartisan and genuinely fair and balanced.
There's the really big question, and we're going to have to pick it up on another night. We're very grateful to you for shining a light on this tonight, Frank Rich. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Frank Rich, columnist and associate editor for the New York Times. We are joined now from Washington by John Harwood, national political editor, not of the editorial page, of the Wall Street Journal. John Harwood, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
So, an incredible furor in these last days out of the blogosphere and right across the political sphere over Dan Rather and CBS and this report. How do you interpret the political impact of all this, John? I guess first question, does this leave George Bush essentially inoculated against this story for the balance of the campaign season?
Well, I think George Bush was substantially inoculated from this story by the fact that he's been president of the United States for the last 4 years. The issue of his participation in the National Guard and what the circumstances of his service were was not a big issue in the 2000 campaign. That's probably when it had the most potential impact. Democrats do believe that it helped them over the last couple of weeks in, first of all, diverting attention from John Kerry, questions about John Kerry's Vietnam record, and raising some questions about George Bush fitting in with the theme that they're presenting of George Bush as a child of privilege, a fortunate son, they call him, who's benefited from favors and given out special favors his whole life. But that story pretty well played out, and I think what's going to happen now is that the CBS apology and the admission that this story essentially was extremely problematic is probably going to end that discussion and let the campaign move on to where it really is going to be decided in the end, which is on Iraq and the economy.
So if we look at John Kerry's big speech today on Iraq, you're saying both the kind of swift boat flap and this are likely to be receding in these last 6 weeks of the campaign.
I don't see how it could be otherwise. You know, you have daily catastrophic violence in Iraq. Today, the savage murder of an American, seemingly nonstop spate of car bombings and high death tolls. At the end of the day, the American people are concerned about this. They don't know what's going on. John Kerry is trying to argue that this is a colossal mistake by the administration. That was the point of his speech, that he wouldn't have made it if he was president. And President Bush, by contrast, is saying we're in a difficult time, but it's one step on the road to a better place when we have a safer Middle East, a more democratic Iraq, and the American people are going to weigh the credibility of those two arguments.
And John Harwood, I just have to ask, you know, there's this conspiracy theory floating around that somehow Dan Rather and CBS got set up and bushwhacked here. Does that have any ring of credence to you or not?
I doubt it. I mean, look, partisans on both sides, it's sort of like the questions about whether or not the Bush campaign was involved in the Swift Boat ads. I've seen no evidence to indicate that members of the Bush campaign were coordinating the Swift Boat attacks in any way. But partisans on both sides tend to think alike. They tend to have similar feelings. They know what will be harmful and helpful to one side or the other. And so certainly Democrats have been enjoying this Guard story, and people who are sympathetic with John Kerry have been helping to push it. That doesn't mean John Kerry's campaign was orchestrating it, just as George Bush's campaign, there's no evidence it was orchestrating the Swift Boat attacks.
Well, and there it goes with Dan Rather's apology. John Harwood, thanks for chiming in with the political implications tonight. Great to speak with you, as always.
You bet.
John Harwood, national political editor for the Wall Street Journal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.